John chapter 8, starting at verse 31 through to 59. And if you're using one of the red Bibles from the church, it's on page 1074. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." They answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves of anyone. How can you say that we shall be set free?" Jesus replied, "Very truly I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. I know you are Abraham's descendants, yet you are looking for a way to kill me, because you have no room for my word. I am telling you what I have seen in the Father's presence, and you are doing what you have heard from your father." "Abraham is our father," they answered. "If you were Abraham's children," said Jesus, "then you would do what Abraham did. As it is, you are looking for a way to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. Abraham did not do such things. You are doing the works of your own father." "We are not illegitimate children," they protested. "The only father we have is God himself." Jesus said to them, "If God were your father, you would love me, for I have come here from God. I have not come on my own. God sent me. Why is my language not clear to you? Because you are unable to hear what I say. You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. Yet, because I tell the truth, you do not believe me. Can any of you prove me guilty of sin? If I am telling the truth, why don't you believe me? Whoever belongs to God hears what God says. The reason you do not hear is that you do not belong to God." The Jews answered him, "Aren't we right in saying that you are a Samaritan and demon-possessed?" "I am not possessed by a demon," said Jesus, "but I honor my Father and you dishonor me. I am not seeking glory for myself, but there is one who seeks it, and he is the judge. Very truly I tell you, whoever obeys my word will never see death." At this they exclaimed, "Now we know that you are demon-possessed. Abraham died and so did the prophets, yet you say that whoever obeys your word will never taste death. Are you greater than our father Abraham? He died and so did the prophets. Who do you think you are?" Jesus replied, "If I glorify myself, my glory means nothing. My Father, whom you claim as your God, is the one who glorifies me. Though you do not know him, I know him. If I said I did not, I would be a liar like you, but I do know him and obey his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad." "You are not yet 50 years old," they said to him, "and you have seen Abraham?" "Very truly I tell you," Jesus answered, "before Abraham was born, I am." At this they picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus hid himself, slipping away from the temple grounds.
Thanks, Samantha. Some of you might find that passage somewhat familiar. Phil preached on it a few weeks ago, and for partly for that reason, I'm going to focus more on perhaps the second part. That's also kind of fits in better with the title I've been given as well, which is this series we're starting on the statements that Jesus makes about himself. I am. Where are we? We're in Jerusalem. And Jesus is teaching at the temple court after the Feast of Tabernacles. Jerusalem would be really crowded, and still was. People traveled from far and wide to come there for the feast, and so it would be a busy place. And there was lots of people around Jesus, people listening to him. And as always in a group, there are different kinds of people, people in different situations, people who respond differently to Jesus, as there will be here today. And Jesus is speaking to everyone in this group, everyone in this crowd, all of his listeners. Some in the crowd are religious leaders, and they oppose Jesus. We see in verse 31, when we pick this up, that some believed in Jesus, to those who believed him, verse 31 says. So there must be some people who accept Jesus' teaching and believed. Well, to those that believed him, what? Goes on to say in verse 32, to those who believed him, the truth will set you free. That is the ultimate freedom that we get through belief in Jesus. And as I say, Phil preached on this recently. We had our talk on freedom and Freedom Day, and is the end of restrictions really a return to freedom? And so I'm not going to go through all of that. It is available if you want to listen to that on our website, or there is a YouTube where we recorded that talk that Phil did. So there's a lot that in this passage on freedom that I'm kind of going to skip. I mean, I'm going to come back to it because I think it's significant and it's important, but I'm going to focus perhaps more on the end. Now, it's important that we recognize this truth, because freedom is something we want, and truth is something that we want. Truth is good. Truth is liberating. Truth will free us. Truth is what we need, even though some people don't like truth, and maybe we don't like certain truths. When some people are presented with the truth, they don't like what they see. They don't like what they hear. When people are confronted by the truth, sometimes they would rather it were different. They push it away. They want nothing to do with it. They want the truth to be different, but the truth is the truth. The truth doesn't change. Sometimes the truth is not what we want. You know, we might look in the mirror and see something. We might do a particular test and find that we're not as good as we were at something. You know, there are truths that may be small examples, but there are truths that we don't like. And maybe there are truths in the Bible that we don't like as well. But that doesn't mean that we can run away from them or ignore them. So to those who believe, this was a beautiful, freeing truth, a life-giving truth, a liberating truth. But whether or not we find it that, whether or not we find it liberating, this truth about Jesus, whether we find it something that we'd rather not accept, something that challenges us, something that we don't like to hear, whichever one we are, it doesn't change that this is real and this is true. The truth is what we need to hear. To be set free implies that there's a problem. You don't free somebody if they're already free. You don't need to. They don't need to be set free unless they are in a particular situation where they are entrapped or enslaved or caught. And so when Jesus says he will free people, he's freeing them from slavery. He's freeing them from a slavery to sin. You know, a doctor doesn't go to someone who is well. A doctor goes to somebody who is sick and who needs to be healed. A doctor would go to a sick person and say that they need to be healed. And that might be a hard thing to hear. And a diagnosis of a poor condition, of a sickness, might be something that's difficult for us to hear. But Jesus also says of himself, he likens himself to that doctor. He says, Jesus said to them, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have come to call the righteous, not sinners." And Jesus is saying, in the same way as the sick need a doctor, so those who owe a debt to God need Jesus to free them. They need him, Jesus, to free them. That true, accurate medical diagnosis might be hard to hear. It might be difficult. We might not want to be told we're sick. But until we accept that and until we recognize that, we won't seek the help that we need and we won't seek the treatment that we need. And the same is true of Jesus. He is the one who says that humanity, men and women, all of us, are slaves to sin and need to be set free. So those who are free because they believe in Jesus. And those who are not free are not free because they refuse to accept Jesus. There's that simple freedom, slavery. Believe Jesus, don't. Accept what Jesus says of himself, reject him. And ultimately, our faith is that simple. Yes, we are to hold to his teaching, goes on to tell us, which is to say that we're to read his word, to trust his word, and to live out his word. The old phrase might be that we are to abide in his word. We're to live lives that are in his word. We live by his word. But when we first believe Jesus, when we first accept Jesus for what he is and for who he is, that is when we are free. And not until that point, not before that point. Let's say, Phil's talked on that quite a lot, so I'll leave it there. I'll come back to it at the end because I think it's significant. There's a little bit that Jesus calls back to or refers back to that I think we need to come back to later. But for the moment, what we need to look at perhaps is, who is Jesus to make an assessment of us? We have to look at who Jesus is. You know, Jesus is making this assessment. You are slaves, and I can set you free. Who is he to make this assessment of us? Who is he to make this claim? How is he able to make this assessment of us? How can Jesus look at the people of this earth and make these statements and make these claims? What does he know? So our new series is looking at these claims that Jesus makes of himself. And if we want to discover who Jesus is, the best way to do that is to see what he says of himself. To see what Jesus says, to see who Jesus says he is. And actually, as we look later in this passage, what we see is these Jewish leaders ask Jesus kind of this same question. So in the crowd, there are those who believe Jesus and there are those who oppose him. And the question is asked by those who oppose Jesus, these Jewish leaders, and they ask him, who do you think you are? In verse 53, who do you think you are? And this is not some kind of polite inquiry of, hey, Jesus, we're eager to learn. We want to know a little bit more about you. Please tell us about yourself. This is not the advertisement for some new episode of a TV show. This is a question, but also it's dismissive and a derisive comment. Who do you think you are? We're the religious leaders. Who do you think you are? It's a judgment from those who think they're better than Jesus, who think they know more than Jesus, who think they are better qualified than Jesus. Jesus had already challenged them and they didn't like it. Jesus had already spoken truth to them and they didn't like what they heard. And I wonder if that's our reaction. Maybe we've heard some things about Jesus that we found challenging and we didn't like. Who do you think you are, Jesus, to tell me how I can live my life? You come here, you make these big statements, you make these big claims, you tell me that I've got it all wrong, you tell me that I have to change. Who are you to tell me, Jesus? Who are you to say that? What gives you the right? It's also a challenge that these Jewish leaders were throwing at Jesus. Who are you making yourself out to be? Who are you making yourself out to be? Who are you claiming to be? In verse 58, Jesus answered their question with some words that get a massive reaction. Before Abraham was born, he says, I am. Some translations remove the word born and simply before Abraham was, I am. Before Abraham lived, I am. Before Abraham existed, I am. Before Abraham was, I am. And perhaps of all of the statements, the I am statements that Jesus makes, this is the biggest. This is huge. It's an enormous statement. It may have slightly less impact on us. But on those listeners, this would have been staggering. You know, sometimes we need to have a level of understanding of a subject, a level of knowledge of a subject, before we can fully understand certain statements or events. You know, Roger Bannister breaking a four-minute mile was probably quite significant for a lot of people. You know, it was one of those kind of metrics. It was one of those things. And if anyone doesn't know who Roger Bannister is, he's the first man to run a mile in less than 4 minutes. But I think this would have been even more significant For all of those people who had tried and tried and tried and tried and thought, it's impossible. We've tried it. We've done everything. All of us have tried it. It can't be done. And then all of a sudden, when Roger Bannister goes and does it, they're the ones perhaps for whom it would have been the most surprising, because they knew what was involved. They knew how hard it was. They knew what an achievement it was. And perhaps in things you're interested in, either your line of work or your hobbies, there are things that you understand perhaps more than I would, and how significant and striking those things are. And those with the most knowledge, with the deepest understanding, would have been shocked and struck the most by this statement. Before Abraham was, I am. For us to read or hear those words, as I say, maybe has a bit less impact, but for those Jews listening, for those Jewish leaders listening, this was earth-shaking. This was huge. And so how did they respond? What do we read in verse 59? So they picked up stones to throw at him. When Jesus made this statement, that was their response. They didn't just want to hurt him. They didn't just want to send him away. They weren't just trying to get him to leave the area. They wanted to kill him. They intended to stone him to death for making this statement. Their reaction was immediate, and it seems like it wasn't just one of them, it was the crowd. A group of them responded similarly. They responded in the same way. Why? Why is that their response to this statement? Well, let's have a look a little bit more in what Jesus says, dig into this statement. The first thing that might strike you is the mixed tenses. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know. That's kind of the thing that maybe struck me. Mixed tenses. Before Abraham was, past tense, history, years ago, I am, present tense. Anyone who's studied or learned a language knows that tenses can be quite complicated. And there's perhaps, if you have studied a language, you might know the answers to this, but I haven't really. I mean, I did a bit of French and German, but nothing significant. But actually, there's an awful lot more tenses than we might think. We probably just use them in our normal language, but there's an awful lot. If you Google, I mean, that's how you find out about everything, isn't it? You Google. You can learn that there are 12 major verb tenses in English, but with some nuances, there are 16 different tenses, and then other languages may have a few more or a few less. And as a slight aside, that's one of the challenges often we have when we're translating a Bible, for example, from Greek or from Hebrew, that some of those tenses are maybe a little bit nuanced and a little bit difficult to translate into different languages, just because of the way that languages work and languages are structured. And like many of you, probably, I learned English from my parents, mostly. They would probably say I learned a lot of it from my friends and school and things like that as well once I got there, but I essentially learned English from my parents. And through my work, I've traveled quite a lot and worked with a lot of people who are not native English speakers, not first language isn't English, but we all speak English because that's kind of the common language. It's always embarrassing when someone asks me a question about English grammar. Like, I mean, what is the blue perfect of this particular verb? And I'm like, I don't even know what a blue perfect is, let alone what it might be of that particular verb, because I didn't learn language in that formal way. I just learned it from my parents. So we see some tenses here, some mixed tenses. Before Abraham was, I am. Using a present tense in the past, referring a what I am now to the... It's perhaps confusing as we read it, as we read it for the first time. Maybe we've seen this many times. Maybe we've read this passage many times and we're a little bit more familiar with it. But the first time we read it, we might think, oh, that's a little bit unusual. You know, everyone involved in this conversation at the time, everyone in that Temple Mount would have known all about Abraham. He'd lived hundreds of years before. God had made a covenant promise to Abraham, which God had fulfilled, despite many of Abraham's shortcomings. God had given Abraham and his wife Sarai a son, Isaac. And the entire Jewish people a nation had descended from this son Isaac. And in Genesis 25, we read about the death and the burial of Abraham. And they talk about it in this passage. Abraham died. He died. He's buried. He was 175 when he died, and he died about 1,850 years before this conversation that we're reading about, before this conversation that was happening with Jesus. And Jesus is saying that even earlier than that, before Abraham was born, so more than 2,000 years before this conversation was happening, before that point, Jesus was. Jesus existed. Jesus lived. Jesus was. See, he was around. He was alive 2,000 years before Abraham. He's saying, I existed before Abraham. But if that was true, then who is Jesus? If that was true, then who is this man? People didn't live 2,000 years. How could he? In verse 57, the Jewish leaders are saying, well, we know you're not even 50. You can't have been around. You're not even 50. And so Jesus is claiming to have lived since before Abraham. And that claim can really only mean one thing. Jesus is claiming some kind of immortality. He must be. And that's a huge statement for him to be making, and one that would have had a big impact on those who were listening to him. But however amazing that might be, it's not really the big issue here. It's not really the biggest thing that he's saying. There's more to his statement. I wonder, as these words were read, I wonder if you kind of looked at that particular choice of words that Jesus said. What did he say? Or perhaps, what didn't he say? He did not say, I have lived for over 2,000 years. Might have been a bit more of a straightforward statement. He did not say, I was alive since before Abraham. He did not say, when Abraham was around, I was already alive. He didn't say any of these, perhaps what might seem like more straightforward statements or explanations. He used some very specific words. He said, before Abraham was, I am. And that might, to our ears, sound like a slightly strange way of expressing this. But it's very significant. And we're going to look at why. Jesus very specifically chose to use those words. And these words would have made it even more shocking, even more awful for them to hear, even more shocking to his hearers, even more incredible. And for us to really understand this, we have to look back at God's dealing with his people, at how God's revealed himself to his people. We have to look back at Jewish history. We have to look back and understand what these Jewish leaders would have known in order to understand why they reacted as they did. Someone's name, you know, is important. Now, I know in our culture, we tend not to pick names that have a particular significance. In other cultures, it's a bit more common to pick names that mean something. Our culture, we tend not to. But someone's name is important. Someone's title, someone's rank is important. And in the Bible, we see the Lord God referred to in different ways, by different names. So before we look at the different names, I want to be absolutely clear. We're not talking about different gods. There are different names for God, but he is one God. One God in three persons, but one God with different names. And we can see God revealed in different names in the Bible. The first name of God in the Bible is that we have recorded is in the story of creation in Genesis, is Elohim. Forgive some of my pronunciation on these. I'm not sure if it's exactly right, but it is Elohim, God, who created the heavens and the earth in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, where we read that in the beginning, God, that is Elohim, created the heavens and the earth. We have that recorded for us. And Elohim is the more general name for God, if I can express it like that, and is used in the context very often of God as creator. It emphasizes that God is powerful, particularly emphasizes that he is not like us. It's used to describe God as an awesome and majestic creator. In our English Bibles, Elohim is usually translated as God, the word God that we have appearing in our Bibles. But there is another name that we have recorded for us in the Bible for God as well. And that name is Yahweh or Jehovah. Now, actually, some of the confusion around the pronunciation of the name, again, is to do with the way the name's written, the way Hebrew works, the fact it doesn't really have vowels, so it makes it difficult to kind of understand exactly how the name would be pronounced. But this is God's personal name. This is God's personal name and is used in the context of the Lord, God, having a relationship with his people. It's the name that he uses. And actually, when God gets personal, this name gets used. So even in Genesis, when God creates humanity, when God creates mankind, it is the Lord God creating mankind. It is Yahweh who does this act, because it's God being personal with his people. He's creating humanity. He's creating mankind. So even as the creator, when it gets personal and God is personally involved, we see this name used. So when the Lord God is personally involved with his people, we see this name Yahweh or Jehovah that is used. And that's the proper designation, the proper name that we have for him. And in our English Bibles, that word, that name Yahweh, is usually translated as the Lord, uppercase. So you might see in the Bibles Lord with a lowercase O-R-D, you might see it capitalized all the way through, and that's that personal name of God. And that's the covenant name that God had with his people of Israel. As I say, it's a little bit unclear about exactly how to pronounce it, because when it's written, it doesn't really have the vowels in, but also because the Jewish people didn't want to utter his name. It was such a personal covenant name of their God. They were scared that if they uttered it, they might be speaking it wrongly. They might be taking God's name badly, and so they were afraid to use it out of reverence and respect. But they were scared to use God's name, and so it kind of the how to pronounce it kind of got lost through the generations. But we have it in written form, so we know that the personal name for the Lord. And so when, as I say, when God is meeting with his people and personally talking to his people, we have this name. So in Genesis 15, the Lord comes to Abraham in a vision. And in verse 7, he says, I am the Lord, Yahweh, who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it. He reveals himself personally. Now, Genesis was most likely written by Moses. And actually, the first time that God reveals himself by this name is to Moses. So God reveals himself to Moses, and then Moses latterly writes the account of Genesis, which would have occurred earlier. But the Lord reveals himself to Moses, and we see that account in Exodus 3. The Lord meets with Moses. And you might be familiar with this. God meets with Moses at a bush that appears to be burning, but doesn't consume. It isn't burnt up. Now, Moses has fled from Egypt. And God wants Moses to go back to Egypt, and wants to send Moses back to Egypt in order to be his mouthpiece so that God's people will be freed. And the Lord appears to Moses as this burning bush, and then Moses goes over to investigate. We can read these words. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face, because he was afraid to look at God. So now go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. God says to Moses, go back to Pharaoh, go back to Egypt. I'm using you to bring my people out. And Moses is terrified. Moses doesn't want to go. And he starts trying to find ways out. He tries to find excuses, perhaps like some of us would. Although perhaps when confronted with the person of God, we may be less looking for excuses. But Moses really doesn't want to go. And after some time, Moses says to God, well, suppose I go to the Israelites. And I say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me. And they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? And God says this. God says to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, capitalized Jehovah, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name you shall call me from generation to generation. So Moses says to God, what if they ask me your name? What shall I tell them? And God says, I am who I am. When Moses says, what is your name? That's how God reveals himself. I am who I am. That is how God reveals himself. That's what God uses as his name. This name, I am, is how God chose to introduce himself, to reveal himself. And this name becomes so sacred, as I say, that Jews don't want to utter it. They don't want to say it. And this is the significance of God's personal name that he reveals to his people and how they are to relate to him. And it's a unique, I am who I am. I am that I am. I am what I am is a unique name that no other being can use. No other being can say that of themselves. We cannot. There's an independence in that name that God has. All other beings are dependent on something, someone. Food, water, warmth, we're all dependent. God is not. God is not dependent on any external thing. He is independent. There's a perfection in this name. We might think, you know, I wish I was this, or I want to be that, or sometime in the future I will become the other. I will be better. No, God doesn't need to be better. God doesn't need to be different. God is perfect. I am. And there's a power, there's a strength in this. There's an immortality all wrapped up in this name that God reveals of himself, simply, I am. And so Moses, when the people ask who has sent you to us, the Lord said, tell them that I am has sent you to them. And that I am is what becomes that name, Yahweh, of God. So Moses had something to tell them, should they ask. Moses would tell them that Yahweh has sent me to you. That I am is that personal, revealed, covenant name that the Lord used to reveal himself to his people. The history of his dealings with his people. And so we come back to this meeting in the Temple Mount after the feast, where the Jewish leaders are asking Jesus, who do you think you are? The whole history of God's people from Abraham through the patriarchs would have been taught to these Jews, standing all of them in the crowd. They would have all known about Abraham. But these Jewish leaders who are challenging Jesus would have been the ones who taught the others. They would have known it even more. They would have been even more familiar with their scriptures. Now, we could say they've missed a lot of the prophecies that happened, but they were familiar with their reading and their understanding of their scriptures. And so when Jesus stands before them and he says the words, before Abraham was, I am, he's not only speaking a name that they didn't utter, he is claiming a name. He is claiming that person of God. He is saying, that is me. Jesus was deliberately taking this terminology that they would have been very familiar with, deliberately taking these words that they would have been familiar with, this context that they would have been familiar with, this history that they would have been familiar with, and he's saying, that's me. I am. They fully understood what he was saying. They weren't confused for a moment. They didn't have to ask him to clarify. Didn't have to ask to say, sorry, what did you mean by that? Could you say that again? They knew exactly what he was saying. And that is why they responded as they did. They took up stones to stone him, to kill him. Because they understood exactly what he was saying. They understood exactly what he was claiming. You see, in their Old Testament law in Leviticus, we read that anyone who blasphemes the name of the Lord is to be put to death. The entire assembly must stone them, whether foreigner or native. When they blaspheme the name, they are to be put to death. And so in their minds, he is so clearly guilty of blasphemy that they picked up stones immediately to kill him. They knew what he was saying, and that is why they reacted as he did, as they did. They knew he was claiming to be God, but they refused to believe him. There's only two options. Either he's telling the truth, which they wouldn't accept, or he's blaspheming, in which case he should die and they should stone him. And they chose that course of action. Now, it's interesting. Some people might think and might say, I don't know if you've ever heard it, well, Jesus never claimed to be God. Yes, he did. These people, these Jewish leaders, picked up stones to stone him because they knew exactly what he was claiming. He was claiming to be God, and they knew that, and that is why they picked up stones. Jesus did claim to be God. From his own mouth, he is saying this of himself. Why is it so critically important who Jesus is? Well, perhaps most obviously because if we want to understand who Jesus is, we have to look at what he says of himself and understand what he says of himself. But it's significant in the context of this passage, because if we look back a little, I said we'll revisit a little. If we look back to verses 34 and 36, Jesus says this, "Very truly I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed." Now Jesus tells him, you're all slaves to sin. That, sadly, is the truth of mankind. We all have a problem. So who can set us free? Well, using this analogy of slavery, of physical, real slavery that they'd been familiar with, they'd have known slaves, they'd have known how slavery worked within that context and that society. Who can free a slave? Well, firstly, the slave cannot free themselves. Can't be done. And therefore, don't look to yourself to be able to free yourself. Secondly, another slave cannot free a slave. One slave cannot free another. So don't look to the people around you. Don't look to the people who are also in the same situation as you are. They cannot set themselves free, and they cannot set you free. They're in the same mess that you're in. But a son can. A son is a member of the family, and a son can set a slave free. And just as in that physical picture of a household and the way that works, so the same is true of our spiritual dimension, where we need the son, God the Son, to set us free from our slavery. And Jesus is stating that he is of the family. He is God. He is of the family. He is not a slave. He is not under the same burden. He under the same situation. He is not under slavery. If the Son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. So in that spiritual realm, we need Jesus to free us from the slavery that we're in, because he is a son. If the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. Jesus is God the Son, and only he can free us. He makes that huge statement about himself, which I think we probably do lose some of the shock of as we read it. It's probably hard to overstate just what an impact that would have had to the people listening. We can judge their reaction. We can judge that impact by their reaction, that pick up stones to stone him. They knew what he was saying. He was claiming to God, using that personal covenant name of God. But he was a man, stood in front of them. This from John Piper. Could Jesus have taken any more exalted words upon his lips? When Jesus said, "Before Abraham was, I am," he took up all the majestic truth of the name of God. He wrapped it in the humility of servanthood. He offered himself to atone for all our rebellion and made a way for us to see the glory of God without fear. The creator, personal God who saved, created the world and then saved his people from Egypt and brought them out, that covenant God, with all of that power in a man, a humble man, a servant, come to die for us. So how do we respond to this Jesus? How do we respond to Jesus' words, and how do we respond to Jesus himself? Well, one response may be just choose to ignore him. That's not a response I'd suggest or recommend, but it's a response some people will have, to just think that we know better. Maybe this had a big shock to them at the time. Maybe this was significant to them at the time, but it has nothing to do with me today. Maybe that's our response. Maybe we ignore him because we think, do you know what? I don't like hearing that. That's not a nice thing to hear. For Jesus to say that I'm somehow a slave, to Jesus say that I'm somehow sick, I've got a problem, I don't want to hear that. That's not what I want to hear. That's not what the world tells me. I can go on Facebook or whatever and find nice, happy things. I don't need to know I've got a problem. Well, if it's true, which it is, then you do need to hear it. We all do. If we're sick, we need that hard diagnosis before we can recognize our position and get better. And the same is true of our spiritual situation before God. This is a diagnosis for which there is a cure. The Son can set you free. Maybe you're offended by this and you want to go and argue with Jesus. Maybe you would have been one of the ones to pick up stones to throw at him. Maybe that's what you would respond to Jesus. How can he claim to be God? I don't know if either of those last two responses or last three responses kind of start to resonate with you. I encourage you just to explore more about what Jesus says of himself. We can run courses here over a few nights where you can just explore more about what Jesus has to say. If you're listening online, get in touch and we can respond to you. We can let you know about some of these courses and opportunities just to look at the claims that Jesus makes of himself, this and others, and explore them and investigate them for yourself. It's worth spending a little bit of time investigating what Jesus says. The right response is to recognize who he is, to come to him. He offers us freedom from slavery to sin. He offers us life, to come to him and accept and put our faith in him and believe in him, to remain in his word, and that truth will set us free. We're going to sing as we close. Jesus is Lord. He is. Jesus is Lord. A cry that echoes through creation. He is the eternal God. God the Son. The King whose glory fills the heavens. That perfect God who yet came to earth as a servant and as a sacrifice for us all. Let's stand and sing.